So welcome to what I think is the fifth or the sixth event that I've been organising with Ilya on broad topics around identity, ethnicity and nationhood. It came out of a research showcase that we both attended 2 years ago now in this coming October, where Ilya was presenting on his own research, and I asked what I now realise is a supremely annoying question when someone's presenting on pre-modern nationhood, is go, how can you talk about nationhood in the pre-modern world? You don't have any of the material conditions, you don't have this, that and the other. And out of the conversation afterwards, where I was put right by Ilya, we came up with the idea of organising a big conference to return to this question and this debate about nations existing in the pre-modern and the modern world, and really as a way of trying to move beyond that debate as the sole problematic through which we approach these questions. So we had, it was a three-day conference with a huge variety of speakers, but also with five keynotes where a pre-modernist would present on their material and a modernist would respond. And out of the from the positive, extremely positive reactions that we had both to the call for papers and at the conference itself, we decided to set up this research network, which is succinctly named The Long History of Identity, Ethnicity and Nationhood, as a vehicle really through which to move beyond the sort of pre-modernist-modernist divide and to address a number of different conceptual, regional, historical questions that allow us to open up these issues from more directions than just when the contemporary nation-state. In the last two terms, we organised workshops on Armenian, Kurdish and Iranian identities, on civic and ethnic identities and the interplay between those, bringing together two speakers, one talking on Carolingian Franca and one talking on early modern China as a way to try and really move into trans-historical and global approach. And out of that, this event came as well. And this is a new format that we're trying, because it's another thing that we want to do, is I know it's very buzzwordy, but sort of find ways of being more innovative in the formats that we choose. We'll see how successful we are with that today, but also to podcast some of our events and to sort of, quote unquote, move beyond the academy. And really the point of the network is to meet as many new people as possible, to find out about new examples and new approaches. So if you have ideas, and more importantly, if you have money, please come and talk to us afterwards, because we'd really like to open up these topics to as many different approaches as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. So I'll just say a few words about the idea of this particular event. And I remember how, as an undergraduate student, I was very much surprised when I come across the following passage in Suetonius' Life of Augustus, and I quote, considering it of great importance to keep the people pure and unsullied by any taint of foreign or servile blood, the emperor was most wary of conferring Roman citizenship and set a limit to my new mission, end of quote. And Suetonius then gives a particular example of the emperor refusing to grant Roman citizenship to a Gaul because he didn't want to violate the honor of Roman citizenship. And this fragment from one of the most famous Roman texts, sort of back then, kind of surprised me a lot because it contradicted what was, and I think often still is, an accepted vision of Roman imperial identity as exclusively civic, built around legal ideas of citizenship, conceptually and institutionally different from what we may want to call ethnicity. And I thought that the passage pointed toward much more complex and entangled ideas of citizenship, belonging, and identity that couldn't be understood within the simplistic dichotomy of ethnic and civic. Well, back then I didn't know Emma Dench's brilliant book, Romulus Asylum, that was published in 2005, and that goes to the core of this complex subject and explores the interconnected categories of blood descent, language, culture, and territoriality, and the construction of Roman imperial identity. And I'm very happy that Emma has agreed to come to Oxford and to contribute to our roundtable on empire and identity because, I believe that your book is one of the main inspiration to rethink our understanding of not only Roman identity in particular, but of imperial identities in general, sort of to get away from the simplified distinction between empire on the one hand and ethnicity slash nationhood on the other hand, and instead to investigate how these concepts and ideologies interplay and overlap across different periods and regions. And I will also mention a couple of other very important contributions that persuaded me that we need to organize this discussion to think more about empire and identity and empire and nationhood. And first, this is a volume which was recently edited by Stefan Berger and Alexei Miller, and it is titled Nationalizing Empires. It was published in 2015 by Central European University Press. And in this volume, the editors and the authors show that while the classic theories of nationalism really focus on nation-states, which are explicitly opposed to empires, in fact, 19th century was dominated by empires, both overseas empires, such as Britain and France, or territorial composite empires, such as Austro-Hungary, the elites of which embraced nationalism and engaged in the projects of building imperial nations, not to transcend empires, but to sustain them. Well, unfortunately, Stefan Berger, who was supposed to be here, couldn't make it. He's a very busy man. But in any case, I really highly recommend to anyone who hasn't done yet this to have a look at Nationalizing Empires volume. And Berger and Miller's volume was focused on modernity, but we should also think about these dynamics and comparable dynamics in the pre-modern world. And I would like to quote here an excellent example from Caspar Hirsch, Alternative History of Nationalism from Ancient Rome to Early Modern Germany, which I believe is a very important book, although I do disagree with it in different ways. Hirsch discusses how imperial elections in Holy Roman Empire in 1519, after the death of Maximilian I, became the focal point for the prolific production and reproduction of German national discourse and the assertion of German identity. And somewhat ironically, in spite of the fact that all candidates to the imperial throne could be described as foreigners in some sense, they all claimed to be Germans, projecting the idea that only a German can be the emperor of what was by then called the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. And once again, we can see how a stereotypical dichotomy of empire and nation unravels and a more complex picture is revealed. And finally, yet another stimulus for this round table was the lecture, which Nick already mentioned, with which we launched our Torch Identity Network in October. It was given by Pamela Crossley from Dartmouth College. And this kind of example moves our discussion beyond Europe, and which is one of the main goals of our network, and shifts this conversation to China and wider to the world of Eurasian empires. And in her lecture, Pamela showed how it were exactly those groups that were constructed as linguistic communities and hence separate peoples by Chinese imperial administration that developed into nationalist movements at the point of the collapse of Chinese imperial order. And in her lecture, Pamela quoted Michael Khodorkovsky's work quite a lot, and therefore we are absolutely delighted to have him here and hope that we'll continue to explore this theme of the influence of imperial languages of power on the construction of non-imperial identities. And with the help of now only one other distinguished speaker, Florian Schwartz, who works very widely on Iran, medieval and modern, as well as Central Asia, we want to address two key issues today. First, we want to get away from the simplistic understanding of imperial identity as civic by definition and examine ethnic notions and discourses in the construction of imperial polities and identities. And second, we want to understand how imperial languages created ethnic and national identities both within and outside imperial borders. And well, today we are going to discuss this across a very long period of time, stretching from Roman Empire to, I still hope, post-colonial nations. But of course, we realize that there are many more important examples and many more interesting imperial polities that we can discuss. And I therefore asked a few colleagues to make kind of short interventions on other periods and places, such as late antiquity, high late Middle Ages, or modern Spanish colonialism. And of course, I very much hope that people in the room will come up with further evidence, with further examples and ideas, and we'll get an exciting comparative discussion going. And I will just ask Nick now to introduce our speakers more formally.
Yes. So I'll introduce our first speaker, introduce each of them as we go along and get the PowerPoint. So as Philia mentioned, our first speaker is Emma Dench, who joins us from Harvard, where she is Professor of Ancient and Modern History and of the Classics. I think modern history in the Oxford definition of modern history as well.
Not even that.
Emma has held a wide variety of august academic positions, but in terms of publications, just like highlights, as Ilya said, Romulus Asylum, Roman Identities from the Age of Alexander to the Age of Hadrian, which was published by OUP in 2005, and also before that, the book From Barbarians to New Men, Greek, Roman, and Modern Perceptions of Peoples from the Central Apennines, both of which are fantastic volumes that I highly recommend. And Emma is currently completing Imperialism and Culture in the Roman World for Cambridge University Press, and is participating in a project on the study of retrospective writing of the Roman Republican past in classical antiquity. So,
thank you so much. Thank you so much to Ilya and Nick, and for the opportunity to be at this amazing, incredibly interesting workshop in this extraordinary surrounding. I'm very impressed. Thank you, Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin money. It's the coolest boost to humanity as one could possibly imagine. How do I do that? Sorry, just need to go. A little primitive. So, terrible apologies to colleagues of mine here who know masses about this, more about this than I do, but I'll try and keep to my allotted and very slim time limit and tell you everything about. My title was, I decided, The Case of Rome, and then I looked back and Ilya's title was The Ancient World and Classical Rome, so I'll try and do all that in 15 minutes, no pressure. Thank you so much. So, let's indeed start way back when, and I definitely think of the Roman Empire. So the first Roman imperial overseas venture started in 264 BCE when the Romans actually crossed the Mediterranean Sea to Sicily. And when they do this, and arguably quite a bit before that, they interact with, piggyback on, negotiate with a very, very long imperial tradition, which goes back to the early Near Eastern empires. Here, I think it just focuses my mind beautifully, starting with the Achaemenid Persian Empire, a relief from the Apadana, the big hall of Persepolis, 5th century BCE, makes me think powerfully of how ancient empires disrupt and reconfigure identities. Sometimes my sort of bottom line of how identities are, as it were, sort of normally in the Mediterranean, would come from the early books of Homer's Odyssey, where characters are asked, who are you, where are you from, etc. And the sort of baseline answer is, I'm from this fiefdom, I'm from this city, my parents are so-and-so. That's sort of how you're rooted. And I think of empires as profoundly disrupting, reconfiguring, and sometimes re-emphasizing particular aspects of identity. So this part of the frieze from Persepolis represents, you can probably see the camel, Bactrians and their camels. So thinking of identities in blocks and a sort of what can you do for us kind of identity. So this is in terms of gifts that are allegedly being willingly brought to the Persian king, and ethnically appropriate gifts. So the Bactrians bring camels. It's from Achaemenid Persian texts that we first hear a collective for the Greeks, which is going to be very important. I'm going to have that as a little red thread through what I say. So we hear about Yauna, the Yauna with their broad-brimmed hats. This is the collective from the it's the Persian version collective of Greeks, but it's a very different collective. It's probably Ionians, the East Greeks, which are being glossed and extended. It's a different kind of collective from the Greeks' own collective, which was beginning to form, which will end up being Hellenes. The Roman Empire, very, very drastically intervenes in identities in very particular ways. I think it's unusually disruptive and unusually generative of identity, and I'll say how. To some extent, it continues the sort of thinking in blocks, the mastery of the world, the what can you do for us, sort of very ancient imperial tradition here, from the cult centre of the emperors in Aphrodisias. This very, very, very remarkably Aphrodisias, ancient Caria, modern day Turkey, very suitable for the donation. A very privileged city in the Roman Empire, we have a representation of the ethnos, the group of the Ethiopians here. There was a whole series of ethnic personifications. So there's the male ethnos, and then there were female figures representing each of the peoples of the world. We have the very familiar imperial idea that the peoples of the world are the same as the peoples of empire, the peoples of the Roman Empire. And it's very significant that this is not, that there was such a collection of ethnic personifications of Rome, but this particular one is not from Rome. I think that's very significant. To some extent, broad continuity. The Roman army, to some extent, the Romans pride themselves on co-opting and remaking ethnic groups. This is a famous representation from Trajan's column in Rome, 1st century CE, detail of Moorish, usually they're called in modern texts, you can see the nice kind of dreadlocks of the Mauritanian cavalry. So the Roman Empire sort of prides itself on having swept up and sort of redeployed peoples of the world. Again, that's a very much, I think, a continuity of ancient traditions. Physically reconfiguring the landscape, Roman roads the Appian Way. I'm very cliche because I'm just trying to sort of talk out at this point. Reconfiguring landscapes, really important. This slide makes me think of what Ilya's very kind words and very incisive words about the Suetonius passage. One of the remarkable aspects of the Roman Empire is the practice, which starts off pretty sporadic, and then there's sort of clusters of grants of the citizenship to foreign peoples. And then finally in 212 AD CE, we get grant of universal Roman citizenship to all free peoples of empire. This relief is actually a freedman and his family. So routinely former slaves were given the Roman citizenship. And I think that the Roman citizenship is a very, very particular way in which the Roman Empire disrupts and generates identities. What I wanted to say, again, picking up from Ilya's excellent points here, is that the Roman citizenship is thought of and performed and acted out not just as a civic identity, but as an effective bond that is manifest. We see the gentleman here, very proudly a Roman citizen with his toga and the arm sling gesture, basically wearing very proudly a citizen dress. So dress, names, language, and as we saw, definitely the ability to think of yourself as part of the Roman race, paradoxically to us, whizzing through. I think that my last thought on how the specific ways, sort of broad brush ways in which the Roman Empire disrupts and configures identities is the extent to which the Roman centre brokers local privilege, local honours and privilege. I think that I increasingly see that as extremely important. The Roman Empire, I think, is correctly, the High Roman Empire is correctly, I think, seen as in very large part a responsive rather than an initiating empire. And I think that one of the effects of this is that almost again, at first like paradoxically, the Roman Empire's interactions bolster and actually help to generate new groups. You know, if you want to get anything done, you want to make a bargaining group. Here, this is a very, very famous example, part of the so-called archive wall, again from the Theatre of Aphrodisias that we've mentioned before. And the archive wall monumentalizes essentially correspondence, especially gifts and honors to the city of Aphrodisias from the Romans over centuries. And also, what I really like, it's quite cheeky, also records some of the honors and privileges that were turned down to other communities that were in competition with Aphrodisias. I promise you I'm going to be very brief. I just wanted to say a little bit about how some of these kinds of interaction and disruption and generation, how they're taken up, how they're actually experienced. It's very difficult to separate the two because I've been using examples from Aphrodisias, from a city in the Roman Empire already. But I'll try. One that modern scholars have liked a lot is dual or even triple or more identity performance. So this very well-known monument from early 2nd century CE Athens of Philopappus. And Philopappus, in his monument, is celebrating essentially three identities. It's very, very hard to get modern photographs that show the features well enough at all. This is Philopappus's Athenian archon, so as high local magistrate of the city of Athens within the Roman Empire, bare-chested. This is Philopappus as Roman consul, and there are also allusions to the fact that he's the heir of a now defunct kingdom within the Roman Empire, the Kingdom of Commagene. It's a fantastic illustration of triple identity. We also have very regularly, this is very, very familiar, especially in the UK, hyphenated gods, Sulis Minerva, a very sort of Greco-Roman, if you like, representation what's commonly called a Celtic goddess. My fave from the British Museum, Horus, wearing the military cuirass of a Roman Empire, who's co-opting which power is a nice nice question. I wanted to just signal a little bit about grouphood. This phenomenon of columbaria, the dovecot-like disposal of the dead in a made community. Columbaria are a big phenomenon 1st to 2nd century CE, particularly of freedmen. For me, this symbolises a kind of group making. There's a huge sort of desirability of forming a group in the Roman Empire, and some of those groups are ready-made, some make themselves. This is one of the more generative aspects of the Roman Empire. And very lastly, Ilya talked about the phenomenon of language that we would associate with race, so of ethnic descent, of blood. I wanted to sort of signal that as well as the availability of signaling multiple identities in different contexts and, you know, bringing them all together in a monument like this, that the Roman Empire also generates increasingly, I think particularly first to second century, late first, second century CE, sort of very exclusive identities. One of these is actually Greekness, which the emperor starts essentially policing. Who is more Greek than someone else, as it were. This quotation from the martyrdom account of Saints Perpetua and Felicity, to my mind, is also a very interesting example of an exclusive kind of identity. Poor old Perpetua, when she's being encouraged essentially to say that she's not Christian and to save her life, and to she's got an infant son, a father, and whatever. And this is the one of the dialogues with her aged father, who's brought in and beaten up, and it's really, really horrible. Father, I said, do you see, to give an example, this vessel here, a pitcher or whatever it is? And he said, I see it. And I said to him, can it be called by any other name than what it is? And he answered, no. So I also cannot call myself other than what I am, a Christian. And I'm very struck by, in our period, the interplay between very exclusive all-or-nothing identities and the availability of, you know, being able to perform multiple identities all at once. I think I'll leave it there because I know we want lots of time for discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Setting up the conversation very well. So I introduce our next speaker, who's Florian Schwartz, who joins us from Vienna, where he is the director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the Austrian Academy of Sciences and also an affiliate professor for Iranian Studies at the University of Vienna. Florian has published on a really fantastically broad variety of topics in the medieval Persian, Central Asian world, and early modern worlds, including on manuscript cultures, the material culture of Iran and Central Asia, numismatics, monetary history, historical geography, landscape history, urban history, including both the practical side of things and the legal history, as well as intellectual communities and networks in Iran and beyond in the early modern period. And all of this comes together very nicely in a volume that I personally quite like on wine culture in Iran that you co-edited, which I think shows the real variety of interests that Florian has. So we're very happy to have you here and look forward to your talk.
Thank you. The wine culture volume is usually not the one I promote very much in Iran, but I left it. Thank you so much for having me here, for inviting me to this wonderful building. I now understand why everyone here is so stylish and with the background of this endowment in the building. And I'm happy to be here and to talk a little bit from a different angle on, I think, everything from medieval to modern Iran and Central Asia. That's what the title says. And you have it here on this one slide that I'm going to show. The Achaemenids, we can't do without them. I'm very happy about Emma's first slide. And it's on the invitation. The Mongols, should take center stage more or less in my presentation, and then colonial Central Asia. So I have a few vignettes, let's say. So the first one is called tentatively Re-Emerging Empire or Nuclear Ethnic Territorial State, ? The Mongols and the Concepts of Iranian Land. In the first half of the 13th century, a large Asian nomad confederation led by the Mongol Genghis Khan and its first successors carved out one of the largest empires in history. This is well known. In the course of the 13th century, several distinct Mongol sub-empires, if you might call it this way, emerged, among them the so-called Ilkhan, the Mongols of Iran. Although short-lived, just three quarters of a century, it had enormous effects on the history of Iran. One important legacy of the Ilkhans was the revival of the concept of the Iranian lands. For the region stretching from Mesopotamia and eastern Anatolia through the Iranian plateau to the lowlands of southern Central Asia. So this is here the Ilkhan Empire in the framework of the entire Mongol Empire. The notion of Iranian lands in Persian, Middle Persian, Iran Shah or Iran Zamin can be traced back to the early Sasanian kings in the 3rd century. It fell out of use, so it was really an imperial construction by the early Sasanians. It fell out of use both in language and in political or administrative practice after the Muslim conquest in the 7th century. So with the Muslims, we return to the more or less natural divide between Western Iran, more oriented towards Mesopotamia, and Iran east of the Central Desert, more oriented towards Central Asia. And there's no concept of Iran as a political territorial entity. This remains with the Mongols. So this political territorial concept with obvious ethnic undertones and a nostalgia for a regional tradition of empire, it re-emerged under the Mongols in the 13th century, who tend to be seen as an alien empire to the region. And the great historians of Iranian Islamic civilization, and this fact that with the Mongols re-emerges Iran, has made many modern historians, especially in Iran, feel quite uncomfortable. What exactly would it imply? An emerging proto-national territorial ethnic Iranian identity? This would be a possible way out of the dilemma for modern historians. But it neglects the imperial aspect of the notion. The description of the lands of Iranians in Mongol period Islamic sources is framed in multiple imperial references, Iranian and Islam. As it is described in the sources, it covers the territories of the pre-Islamic Sasanian Empire. There's a very clear reference to that. But it is also the geographical heart of the Islamic Ikomene, and I'm citing here from the sources. And it is where the capital of the Abbasid Caliphate was located, and the capital of the Sasanians. So we have all these different references to the Islamic and pre-Islamic empire here in this. But without that, one still has to keep in mind that this revival of the Sasanian notion of Iranian empire was only possible because the Mongol rulers of Iran created a political space that was geographically largely congruent with the pre-Islamic Sasanian empire that had not existed before. This was more or less rather identical with the Sasanian territory. This was recreated more or less by chance with a different centers that are by the Mongols, and with that re-emerges this concept. So in this term, Iranian land, in the 13th century, notions as diverse as the nostalgia for pre-Islamic and Islamic empire and the realities of Mongol empire building came together. So this is the first observation. The second, the history of the Ilkhanate as other empires in the Islamic world tended to be written from the perspective of the imperial subjects, or rather a certain segment of imperial subjects. And I think this is a very important point. So it is the Persian writing elites who are not necessarily ethnically defined, Persian or Turkish, sometimes very difficult for us to really understand. I will come back to that point a little later. So one of the most famous historians of this period, Rashid ibn Fazlallah, was a converted Jew who converted to Islam, and was multilingual, Persian, at least Persian and Arabic. This history is written from, say, the perspective of the imperial subjects. It's not a Mongol history of Iran. It's a Persian history of Mongol Iran. And one recurring trope in this historiography is the enculturation of the Aryan conqueror by the conquered. So making the Mongols Iranians, rather than the imperial conqueror reshaping. That's what the sources, the perspective of the sources. This is not necessarily, let's say, this is of course fiction, as much as it is also part reality. So a very, very complex relationship. I quote a historian, because the quote is so nice. Actually, the problem is the historian did not live in the Ilkhan Empire. He lived in Cairo and Damascus, but he quotes from eyewitnesses. Really, he gives you the names, so I think he really gives you perspective. He writes around 1314, just after a few years after the end of the Ilkhan Empire. He writes, the Iranians made the Mongols marry their daughters and married themselves the daughters of the Mongols, and integrated, literally mixed, the Arabic term here, them into all aspects of their affairs. Therefore, their laws, the Persians' laws, are respected by the Mongols, and the Mongols consider in most affairs the rules of the caliphs and the kings. In other words, the Mongols became fully integrated into Iranian society, and the active party in this process were the Iranians, the conquered. So this short paragraph has multiple implications. How did he describe the two parties in this interaction and this cultural integration process? He's actually not using the terms Iranians and Mongols as I use in my translation. He does not pitch Iranianness or Persianness or Islam or Muslimness or Tajik, as they often use, against Tatar, a common term for Mongols or Mongol Turks. He says simply, the people of this domain, of this dominion, Ahl-Hathi al-Mamlika, for those of you who know Arabic, and the barbarians, Al-Ajam. So, first, there's any differentiation or specification of the imperial subject population, be it ethnic, religious, or in any other ways, is absent. It is replaced by a generic affirmation of belonging to a coherent territory, something perceived vaguely as constituting a somewhat natural kingdom, mamlaka. And I think he has this Iran-Zamin in mind, the Iran-Islam. From the context, this is clear that he has this in mind. Second, the term which I rendered Mongols is Ajam. This is an Arabic word. It is a term literally meaning barbarians and applied in the early Islamic period to any non-Arab. Then it became slowly a term more specifically used for Iranians, and it lost its pejorative undertone. So it was just Arabs and Ajams. It's no longer the good Arabs versus the pure Arabs versus the barbarians, but it's just simply Arabs and Iranians. So in Al-Omari's text, it reassumes its original meaning. But however, while in the early Islamic conquest, it was the Arab empire builders, the Arab conquerors, who subsumed the new subject population under this generic term of barbarian, it is now the conquered subject population that passes the term on to the new Mongol Turkish conquerors. The former barbarians of the early Islamic empire passed the baton on to the new barbarians, the Mongols. In the fiction of the conquest of the conquerors through enculturation, a dichotomy between conquered and conqueror is maintained at the expense of differentiation, which makes historical research into some of the questions of identity sometimes quite complicated. At the same time, of course, see that this trope undermines its own, it itself, because it sits, the sits im Leben of this, if you like, the German term, is the actual process, the verbalist process of interaction, their acculturation, so we don't have this dichotomy if we look at it as historians. So, I don't want to dwell too much on that, but it's communal differentiation entirely absent from Al-Umari's description of the Mongol Empire. It's not. But there's an interesting distinction to be made when he describes in his text, which is part history, part geography, he describes the main constituents of the Mongol Empire, like the four that we see here. And when he writes about the Ilkhanate, which is really squarely in the Islamic ecumene, he uses entirely Islamic concepts. He gives very detailed geography without any reference to people or to ethnicity or anything to the population. It's just by belonging to a place, but he doesn't even refer to people, he just refers to places. As soon as he moves to the borders or crosses the borders into other parts of what is still the Mongol Empire, but outside the Islamic sphere, he starts to talk about people. So he gives a list of provinces that constitute the Ilkhan Empire, and then he says, the Khanate of the Golden Horde, the Khanate of the Kipchak, is constituted by the Cherkess, the Rus, and the As. So the Cherkess, the Russians, and the Alans. And then he talks about the Turks. So here he gives an imperial ethnography of that region, which he does not do, he said, for the Ilkhan Empire. So behind this, I think stands, we've referred to that already, the fiction of the legal equality of citizenship, if you like, of the Muslim population, and the systematic neglect for non-Muslims in some of the sources, or heterodox communities. So this gets me to a third point, we'll be very brief on this one. The legal concept of an equal standing, the legal standing of the Muslim population, if you wish, the legal fiction of a Muslim citizenship tends to shift the attention in Islamic texts from ethnic identities to a wide array of other communal identities. So there is a huge amount of differentiation about evidence for communal, imperial, or community state, or whatever, interaction. But it is usually not framed in terms of ethnicity or of belonging to a group of people with, well, there's a very strong sense of geographic belonging. This is very, very clear. And genealogy does play an important role, descent groups and families. And there's an interesting merger between Islamic and inner Asian traditions of social organization and spirituality, which over the course of the 15th century led to the emergence of communities of recently Islamized nomads and sedentary Muslims around Muslim religious elders. So we have very strong communities that bring these different pre-Mongol communities like, together. And some of them become very, very, they were very great social and political influence. Maybe the best known example is the Safavid rulers of Iran since around 1500, who started as a religious community that brings together recently Islamized Turco-Mongol communities and then a Muslim religious group. To some extent, also the Ottomans, or at least it's an aspect of the Ottoman ascendancy as well. Final point, imperial ethnography versus fiction of unity, and here I get closer to the modern period, away from the Mongols. In the 19th century, the discursive formation of minorities in the modern sense is intricately interwoven with the emergence of notions of ethnicity and nation. So we talk about minorities more and more in terms of ethnicity and nation. As many Europeans saw it, and maybe you will disagree in the light of the discussions you're having here, But I think so to say that as many Europeans saw it, nationality and ethnicity were not equally distributed. Without too much exaggeration, one may put it this way, Europe came to perceive itself as a community of nations, while much of the rest of the world, including Southwest and Central Asia, was seen as a mosaic of ethnic and religious or ethno-confessional communities embedded in very underdeveloped nations. And this is something that is still very present in modern, for example, diplomacy or international politics, these notions. So they're not completely irrelevant. In the same period, large Eurasian imperial formations, such as the Ottoman Empire and in particular Russian, Imperial Russia, experienced intensive debates about the relationship between ethnic, national, or religious communities and empire, between empire, nation, ethnicity, and citizenship. So if we look, this is just the background, if we look from that background to 19th century Iran, it seems these discourses seem very underdeveloped. There's a very low intensity of public discourse about ethnicity, broadly defined, and one might gain the impression that identity or minority questions or whatever were virtually absent from public discourse in Qajar, Iran, so 19th century Iran. If one takes a closer look, this of course doesn't hold true. There's outbreaks of intercommunal violence that did trigger discussions about specific communities as minorities or as ethnic groups among Iranian intellectuals. But in general, the intensity of these debates is very low until the beginning of the 20th century. So if you look at a different part of the Iranophone world, southern Central Asia, this was came under Russian control in the 1860s, and one of the first scientific enterprises undertaken by the Russian imperial conquerors was the so-called Turkestan album. A set of three photographic albums produced only within the first 5 years after the conquest, in the early 1870s. At the center of this book, and you see one page in the bottom right corner, are two volumes on the ethnography of the newly conquered region. It contains, in the first part, almost 100 individual portraits of men and women of different ethnic groups, Narodnost in Russian. Statistical, ethnographic, and geographic reports list dozens of ethnic tribally separate categories. So producing exactly this mosaic of communities that served to underpin the Russian project of an empire in the region. And this had, in the long run, a very strong impact on this part of the, like, what used to be the Iranian world, if you like, there's still today public discourse in the Central Asian republics, for example, is very much dominated by this discourse of nationalities and minorities. The Qajars who were the ruling dynasty, and if you like, a minor empire since the late 18th and into the early 20th centuries, were also increasingly concerned with a process of appropriation through exploration, but it did not take on this ethnographic perspective. It seems to have been partially influenced by European imperial or colonial models, but has also its own traditions. We see a flurry of Persian domestic travelogues and geographic accounts in the 19th century, very often sponsored by the ruling household or even the ruler himself traveling and having someone taking a diary of his travels, really appropriating his territory. But the focus is very different from what we see in the imperial Russian colonial administration. The Qajars were interested in defining or construing imperial authority and legitimacy through the description of and appropriation of territory, of antiquities, and local genealogical traditions, but not in any way ethnicity. A taxonomy of people or peoples was not a primary concern. Systematic ethnographic documentation is conspicuously absent from Qajar era photography, for example. We don't have pictures of ethnic groups within the empire. Was Qajar Iran less imperial than Russia, or than its very distant forerunner, the Achaemenid Empire? Is this the final stage in a de-imperialization of the notion of Iranian lands, in which, in the course of growing national consciousness, ethnic and tribal identities weed, as historian Jean Aubin argued, or is it evidence of a different approach to empire, an approach where the legal fiction of Muslim citizenship and the realities of communities, which are not primarily defined in terms of ethnicity, but have prevailed? So these are some of the questions that one might ask based on this material. And I stop here. It's talk very too much. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Already from our first speaker has lots of questions, but beforehand, it's my pleasure to introduce our third invited speaker, Michael Bodakowski, who joins us from the Loyola University in Chicago, where he is professor of history. Mike is a historian in particular of the Russian Empire, but specializes in the history of Russia's frontier expansion, imperial expansion into the Eurasian borderlands. He's published widely on this for a number of years, and really the person for this topic. So I'm extremely excited to hear what he has to say. I'll just highlight a couple of publications, Where Two Worlds Met, The Russian State and the Kalmyk Nomads, 1600-1771, which was published in 1992, and really set the stage for later publications. And Russia's Steppe Frontier, The Making of a Colonial Empire, 1500-1800, published by Indiana University Press in 2002. And these are really indicative of a very strong welcome contribution to the topic. So we're extremely excited. You can sit there if you prefer or speak here.
I'll stand for a change. Thank you. Thank you very much, Leah and Nick, for inviting me. Thank you, the Academy. Oh, that's Oscars, I'm sorry. All right, I'm taking you to pre-visual. I didn't bring any slides with me, just pre-visual age, if you remember that. It is, of course, a truism to say that Russia was an empire that, like its imperial symbol, the double-headed eagle, simultaneously faced east and west. What is important, however, that Russia's imperial challenges and therefore the government objectives and policies differed substantially in the West and East. In the West, Russia confronted sovereign Christian states with distinct political and geographic boundaries. In the East, from the middle of the 16th century onward, Russia might be conceptualized as an early modern colonial empire, extending into the areas populated by multitudes of peoples whose societies were primarily tribal, with segmented political authority, nomadic or semi-nomadic, and above all, non-Christian, animist, Muslim, and Buddhist. Excuse me. No clear state boundaries could be drawn here, and only a fluid zone of uncertainty, a frontier, separated advancing Russian posts from the indigenous population. It is here in what would later become known as Asiatic Russia that the government policies, first inadvertently and later deliberately, created ethnic and national identities of the various indigenous peoples. In other words, the main question I ask here is how did the tribes become peoples, ethnic groups, and nations, and what was Russia's role in this process? From the beginning of its expansion east and south in the 16th century, Moscow's main concerns were geopolitical and military, with the exception of Siberia, where a commercial value of furs predominated until the 18th century. During the first encounters with the indigenous peoples, Moscow invariably insisted that they become the Tsar's faithful subjects. Their subject status was not open to negotiations. The subject status of the natives in the empire's southern and eastern frontiers was conceptualized in specific terms, which were used only in these regions. All of these terms were of Turkic origin and indicated that Moscow conceived of itself as a legitimate heir to the Golden Horde. I'll briefly mention the terms. One of them was called Shert, which Moscow insisted to be an oath of allegiance of the native peoples to the Russian Tsar, which I argued, of course, was no more than a mutual treaty from the point of view of the indigenous peoples. The other was Yasak, which Moscow implied to be a tribute, but in fact, again, I argued from the point of view of the indigenous population, was simply an exchange, a bartering exchange of sorts, because without it, there was no so-called tribute. The third one was called Amanat, which was an institution of hostages, which once again, natives understood in very different terms of their own society, not as a real hostage in our sense, but as a sort of a sending a usually the eldest son of some chief as a respected guest to, or kunak is the term, to the Russians. And finally, gifts and annuities that were sent regularly to various native peoples and their leaders, which Moscow again considered to be gifts and annuities as a from a sovereign to the subjects, but in fact very often were considered to be tributes paid to the natives by Moscow. So I wrote extensively about the Russian frontier, the relationship between Moscow and many of its newly acquired subjects, and I argued that initially all these this relationship was based on structural misconception and misunderstanding of each other. Where Moscow saw a suzerain subject relationship, the natives saw a mutual military alliance of partners. In time, however, roughly by the early mid-18th century, Moscow succeeded in defining the relationship in its own terms and turning the natives into subjects. Now, the question was how to rule and integrate the new subjects into the empire. How to tame and rule kinship-based tribal societies, usually organized in some sort of political confederation. The Russian government's preferred policy was promoting a central authority, one leader in a society with fragmented political structures. This also meant becoming deeply involved in the power struggle in the native societies, taking sides, favoring some and antagonizing others, and providing financial and other incentives to the loyalists. In short, the Russian state acted as a great disruptor of the traditional balance of power, and in time, finding itself in a position that many US conservative foreign policymakers always want to avoid, but never can, and that is the business of state building or nation building that is often discussed in US foreign policies today. Promoting one leader and a centralized rule among the tribal peoples meant that the Russian authorities preferred to overlook the tribal and clan identities and to conceptualize a people as one. For example, the Chechens consisted of a great variety of clans and never referred to themselves under such name. They were known to their neighbors by the name of a specific clan on the borders of various neighboring peoples. The Russians learned the name Chechen from the Georgians and then applied the name Chechen to all related but different clans. Adding to the confusion of changing names and unfamiliar concepts was the difficulty that Russians had imagining a people without a state and a single ruler. It was almost a revelation to the Governor General of the Caucasus, Potemkin, who observed in the late 18th century, quote, "The peoples referred to as the Chechens and Kumeks do not comprise real nations under such names, but every village has its own chief and is governed by its own laws." We can trace some of the early steps in an attempt to classify various peoples of the empire. In early modern times, what we would call today ethnic and professional identities were often blurred and considered synonymous. For example, an official description of the peoples in the mid-Volga River in the 17th century referred to the Cheremis, as a kind of ethnic group, and the beekeepers, which was a certain group of Wachaks, in one sentence, as if these were the same categories. In the late 18th century, Russia's prominent government official and representative of the Russian Enlightenment, Prince Mikhail Shcherbatov, offered a classification based on the service to the state, religion, and lifestyle. It was a hodgepodge of different identities and the specifics of it. By the late 18th century, Russia's diverse empire included Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant Christians, along with Jews in the West, and Muslims, Buddhists, and pagans in the South and East. The government needed to identify various peoples, both collectively and individually. The non-Christians were now more systematically referred to as inoверцы, which means of a different faith, and by early 19th century as инородцы, which means of a different origin, descent, and later race. The two terms conflated notions of people and faith, emphasizing unmistakably that the non-Christians were different from the Russians in both religion and race. Religion also marked the boundaries in the use of the term nation, Nazi in Russian, which largely was reserved for the Christian peoples, Georgians, Armenians, within the Russian Empire, while the non-Christians were referred to as Narod, or Yudi, which means simply people. In the early 19th century, as the Russians began to discover their own history and identity, Russia's non-Christian subjects were acquiring their own narrative in the form of ethnography. Dozens of German scholars descended on Russia, traversing the huge empire and leaving the accounts of exotic regions and peoples. One could no longer avoid addressing the core issues of the Russian identity. What was the Russian state, Russian nation, Russian empire? Were these notions synonymous? If not, what was the relationship among them? The emergence of Russian national historiography in the early 19th century was exemplified by Russia's first official court historian, Nikolai Karamzin. In his first version, Russian history focused on a history of the Russians proper. In his version, not first. Accounts of the non-Christian peoples, by contrast, increasingly branched out into a separate field of study and eventually laid the foundation for Russia's Orientalism, mostly centered at Kazan and St. Petersburg universities. Curiously, the authors of the first studies of the non-Christians were members of the non-Christian elite, who later became critical in constructing the new ethnic identities among the empire's non-Christian peoples. This new colonial elite, consisting of men raised in their indigenous societies and then educated in Petersburg and Kazan, became a conduit for the modern ideas of ethnicity and nationalism. At different times, various representatives of this elite created the alphabets for the indigenous languages, collected and wrote down the local folk tales, compiled the codes of the customary law, and authored the embryonic history of their people. Among those who created the ethnographic, well, I won't mention the specific names, most of them non-Russians, the rise of the local ethnic and cultural identities throughout the 19th century moved hand in hand with the further crystallization of the Russian national identity and the canon of Russian historiography. While Russian historians may have had different interpretation and topical emphasis, they all assumed Russian history was separate from that of the non-Christians. For conservative historians such as Platonov, there was only one Russia populated by Russians. But even for liberal historians, Russia was either a reluctant empire destined to expand and colonize available lands, Vasily Kuchevsky was one representative of this, or one that pushed forward towards its natural frontiers, Vladimir Solovyov. All concurred that Russia's expansion was inevitable, and that the mission to civilize the savage and perfidious peoples along the imperial frontiers demanded conquest and eventual Russification. Throughout the latter part of the 19th century, the Russian authorities used the notion of a civic consciousness, гражданственность, as a measure of evolutionary progress and civilization, and as a main marker distinguishing various non-Christian peoples of the empire from the more civilized Russians. How much time do I have? Five? minutes, 10 minutes, okay. Let me give you one very quick specific example of this colonial elite, of those who were brought up in their indigenous societies and for various reasons found themselves within Russia, usually as a demand of the Russian authorities, were educated there and became the founders later of the ethnic and national identity among their own peoples. One of these names comes from the region of the North Caucasus in the late 1830s. His name was Han Giray. So he was a Russian officer, very well educated. He writes the treatise and notes on the Circassia, his region. He compiled the Circassian alphabet on the basis of the Cyrillic script, and he began to write down the history, the folklore stories of history of the Adyghe people, which is a proper name for the Circassian people. Nicholas I, the Emperor of Russia, called Han Giray the Karamzin of Russia, that is, the founder of Karamzin of Circassia, the founder of the Circassian history, in other words, which later did not prevent him from banning, quote, the notes on the Circassia from publication. Shortly after Han Giray's premature death at age 34, his collection of historical tales appeared in the publication under the title of the Circassian Legends and Tales. In the late imperial and early Soviet period, in particular, Han Giray was construed as a founder of the historical and literary tradition of the Western Adyghe, and another similar individual, Shora Nogma was his name, was construed as the founder of this tradition among the Kabardins, the Eastern Adyghe. It is not as if other options in constructing local traditions and identities did not exist, as that we just heard in the Qajar Empire. It's very interesting. For instance, the first attempts to compile the Adyghe alphabet and to translate the Quran into the Adyghe were made in the early 1820s by the Effendi Mohammed Shapsugh and other people, but any such efforts were firmly opposed by ulema, for whom the only written language was Arabic, the sacred language of the sacred book. Likewise, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, several prominent Muslim jurists in northern Dagestan made important contributions to study of the Sharia and Islamic discourse, but made no attempt to create alphabets for local languages or to consider the issue of local history and culture. The task of constructing ethnic identities fell on the Russified local elite and Russian scholarly and government officials. After all, ethnicity was a Western concept brought from Russia. The ironies of the empire were often inescapable, as in the case of Shoranovna, who was greatly influenced by Sjögren, an ethnic Finn educated at a Swedish gymnasium at the time when his homeland was part of Sweden, and who later continued to write in Swedish. Shortly after Finland became annexed to the Russian Empire in 1809, Sjögren became a conduit of the Western ideas in the Russian imperial periphery and was bestowed with the membership in the Russian Academy of Sciences. It was a Russified Swedish Finn who brought the modern ideas of ethnicity, philology, and historiography to the North Caucasus. Constructing ethnicity was a multifaceted project, requiring, first of all, a consolidation of cultural and historical identity, but also a defining of the communal boundaries based on their socioeconomic activity and political affiliations. It was a colonial project to an extent that ethnicity meant prevailing over the tribal differences in order to respond to the outside demands and expectations, in this case, those of the Russian Empire. While different group identities existed before the modern age and Russian invasions of the 18th and 19th century, they were fundamentally reconceptualized and institutionalized as ethnic identities through the contact with the Russian imperial structures. In other words, modernity arrived in a form of ethnicity nurtured within the Russian colonial empire. The most important forces that worked against the emergence of the ethnic identities were Islam and Pan-Turkism, which attempted to unify the peoples of Asiatic Russia on the basis of religion and quasi-race. The Russian government saw these identities as the main threat, and fostering ethnic and national identities seemed the best way to counter it. In the Communist Manifesto, now you're surprised, Karl Marx maintained that the bourgeoisie produces its own grave diggers, the proletariat. The same could be said of empires. In order to rule the imperial subject, the empires tend to create ethnic and national identities, which eventually help to undermine and break up the same empire that created them. Ethnicity is empire's Frankenstein. In the colonial context, discovering, imagining, and narrating one's people's past is a subversive enterprise. With the collapse of the Russian Empire, the Soviet anti-religious and ethnicity building or nation-building policies became a part of the same dual process. The real construction of ethnic and national boundaries took place in the Soviet times. But like those of the Russian Empire, the Soviet nationality policies sanctified the same grave diggers that finally buried the Soviet Union in 1991. The grave is still fresh, the ground is unstable, and many non-Russian peoples continue to dig hard within today's Russian Federation. The question is still open whether modern Russia can survive the tensions generated by the non-Russian ethnic and religious elites and identities that it once helped to create. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to all of three main speakers. As I mentioned at the very beginning, I asked a few other colleagues to contribute additional perspectives to the different imperial periods of politics, and I'll just very briefly introduce them. First of all, it's Brian himself, who doesn't need much introduction. He's a professor of late antique history here, also director of the Ertegun program, and principal investigator of St. Scouts Project. It's also Eliza Hartrich, who is a junior research fellow by examination at Bodmin College, and she, I think, is now turning her PhD book on urban politics and urban political culture and in late medieval England, but also working on new, very exciting for me personally, topics of the construction of urban and ethnic identities in late medieval British Isles. And Elizabeth Bolorinos Allard, who is a doctoral candidate in Spanish at Trinity College, Oxford, and who's working on modern Spanish colonialism and the construction of Moroccan Jewish, Muslim, and sort of Spanish colonial identities in the first half of the 20th century. And I think I will ask you to make sort of short interventions on your respective periods and subjects, and then we hopefully will have 30 minutes for an open discussion.
Is it best to stand up?
That's up to you. Yeah.
Okay. I'm interested in the very late Roman Empire, and I've written a book about the collapse of the Roman Empire, and I got very struck by the fact that almost all modern empires have collapsed because people wanted to get out of them. That is strikingly not true of the late Roman Empire. There is one possible case, Britain, documented in a 6th century source recording events in the 5th century. That is the only decent case of people wanting to get out, with one notable exception. The Jews were never very happy being in the Roman Empire, and in fact they revolted consistently throughout the time of Rome. But if you're going to list reasons why the Roman Empire collapsed, people wanting to get out is definitely very, very, very low down that list. There is plenty of oppression, there is plenty of dissatisfaction, but it is social. It's people at the bottom of society not liking their masters, who are often locals. There are these people called Bacchaudae who revolt in the 3rd and 5th century, but they are revolting against their landowners just as much as they are revolting against Rome. It is, as it were, a social revolution, not ethnic revolution. Strikingly, in the West, for instance, you know, people have come to learn Latin, speak Latin, except in very obscure places like Britain, possibly, and Brittany. I mean, Rome has, as it were, successfully ethnicized to a large extent its people. Now, we're not talking about nationalism, because nationalism is a 19th century concept of sort of populist mass identity. We're talking about the elites and their sense of identity. But in the Roman Empire, there's a strong sense that the elites share the sense of wanting to be inside Rome. And strikingly, the people who come in also want to be, as it were, within the Roman Empire. People like Alaric the Goth, what he's trying to negotiate is a decent deal within the empire. It's a very, very successful empire. And I was sent a wonderful quote by Neil McKinn. This is Orosius, a 5th century Spanish author writing in North Africa. So he's a provincial writing in another provincial territory. Now, Orosius is very pro-Roman, there's no doubt about that, so I'm not saying this is absolutely the whole story, but Orosius talks specifically about the change that's happened within the Roman Empire, because there's no question at all that the imposition of empire is brutal in the extreme, and people fight it desperately. People like Boudicca in Britain, you know, great heroes of Nan, Vercingetorix in Gaul. I mean, nobody wants to become Roman initially, but strikingly, things have changed by the time you get to the late empire. As Emma rightly mentioned, I mean, 212, there is the introduction of full citizenship. Obviously, full citizenship for the elite. We're not talking about mass citizenship. Also, at the end of the late empire, Italy, which had been exempt from taxation, is taxed equally with everybody else. Crucially also, the emperors, who are really, in effect, I mean, they're military autocrats, but they come from outside Italy, they come from mainly from the Balkan territories, and they operate exclusively in the frontier zones between places like Trier, Constantinople, and Antioch. Where the empire is actually functioning from its frontier zones. So it's a very, very changed place from an empire with an absolute clear centre where all the money and all the power is, as it were, flowing into the centre. It's a very different place indeed. And this is what Orosius says about the world that he's living in the early 5th century. He specifically draws a distinction. The enormous difference between past and present can be seen in the fact that what Rome once, at the time of its conquests, extorted from us at sword point to satisfy her own extravagance, now she contributes with us for the good of the state we share. That is a sense of common identity and common nationhood. I think it's very, very interesting. How they achieve this, and so much more effectively than modern empires, happily talk about if in discussion if anybody wants, but it's a very striking case.
I work on what, by comparison, is a very tiny empire, which are lands conquered by the English in the 11th to 15th centuries in Wales and Ireland. And I think it actually makes quite an interesting contribution to this discussion, because part of the brief is really looking at complicating this idea of a very legally defined, ethnically neutral imperial citizenship by seeing empires as nationalizing projects. And the historiography of the medieval British Empire has always seen it as a nationalizing empire, that there's this group of Bretons and Normans and a few of the remaining Anglo-Saxons from the Norman conquest They'll go over, conquer parts of Wales and Ireland, and then define themselves as English, because all of them are clearly very different from these Gaelic barbarian others. And conversely, the Welsh and the Irish, who are seen by who were groups of many different tribal kingdoms, increasingly, especially as we get into the 14th and 15th centuries, adopt this very self-consciously antiquarian Gaelic identity. We see real revivals in Welsh and Irish poetry in this period, for example, and identification of themselves as Irish and Welsh rather than necessarily as being an O'Connor. And I want to pose some things that I think are problematic about adopting this idea of nationalizing empires wholesale. The first is that when we actually look at these English, Irish, and Welsh identities that are being allegedly created through the crucible of empire, is that they seem to mix and match quite a bit more than we would expect. The English national myth of King Arthur is essentially a Welsh one that they co-opt and create into a story of Englishness. And some of the great Welsh poetry that we see arising from this cultural revival in the 14th and 15th centuries will do things like write these laudatory poems about the English city of Chester. So it's, I guess, how I would see empire is that it is a catalyst for people to construct national identities, but it also widens the repertoire of things you can use to create and form these identities. So empire sort of creates a pick and mix through which we can create national identities. The other wider point that I want to make is looking at identity construction and empires from a very practical level. In the empire I'm looking at, access to the privileges associated with travel, use of metropolitan legal institutions, etc., are restricted to particular nationalities or ethnicities. And I think that's an important point of comparison in empire, to look at our national and our ethnic distinctions part of the way that privileges of empire are made accessible or inaccessible. But the problem in the empire that I'm looking at is how do you enforce these distinctions? An Irish person and a Welsh person and an English person don't look that different. And it's basically a set of external signifiers that are created to enforce differing access to English legal institutions, to travel to various different places within the empire, needing to pay certain customs, etc. So it's things like hairstyle, dress, language, names. And obviously, if you're an Irish or Welsh person and you can present yourself as an English person pretty convincingly, you're not going to be questioned extensively. Conversely, if you're an English settler in Ireland and Wales and you come back to England to trade, etc., if you've settled over there for a couple hundred years, there is a distinct accent in those different localities. Dress styles of the natives have been adopted. So people who are by blood English have their identities questioned when they come back to the metropole. So there is a rhetoric of restricting access to imperial institutions through a language of blood and descent, but in reality it becomes extremely complicated to actually figure these out, and is based largely on very performative elements of identity construction that can be changed. So the last thing that I'd like to highlight is one of the things I think that's come out of our discussion today is this idea that empires convert a more localized sense of identity among the conquered to becoming a larger ethnic, national, people-based identity. But I would really reassert the importance of the local when we're looking at empires. When it's really difficult to tell what someone is in the context of how to, are they Irish, are they Welsh, are they English, what rights should be accorded to them, one way of doing so is basically saying, the people in their locality know this person's ethnic identity, know if they can be trusted to represent Englishness, etc. So it's almost trusting these local designations. So things like urban citizenship, being a citizen of Dublin, is a sign that you are English and you've been accepted as English by the locals, and thus you will have certain trading and travel rights in England. So I guess these sort of very vague inchoate thoughts, it's just to stress that beyond this very seductive narrative of nationalizing empires, there are a lot of complications, and that we should really also keep in mind the idea of identification as something that is essentially and is easiest at a very local, communal level.
Right, well, I'll be very brief so we can get on with the discussion. So my current research looks at Spanish constructions of North African Muslim and Jewish culture during the Spanish colonial campaigns in Morocco in the early 20th century. So Morocco was internationally recognized as a protectorate shared between France and Spain in 1912 and until its independence in 1956. So Spanish colonialism in North Africa provides a fascinating case for analysis of colonial discourse and practice. Because of the Iberian Muslim and Jewish past, and because notions of cultural and ethnic hybridity are incorporated into conceptions of Spanish identity in the colonial period, and actually these notions of hybridity play an important role in the formation of identity in Spanish nationalism. And so this is Africanism, which is a military subculture that emerged in Morocco in the first half of the 20th century from this circle, this military circle. The coup that led to the Spanish Civil War was conceived and carried out. And then within Francoism, this idea of brotherhood between Spain and North Africa is developed further alongside this idea of Spain as an essentially Catholic nation. So it's an interesting case. So during Spanish colonial rule in Morocco, hegemonic as well as non-hegemonic, counter-hegemonic discourse that represents Spain and Morocco as fraternal cultures and explore the Moorish, which is the word that was used then, Moro, and Jewish influences on the Spanish nation. So when I say hegemonic, non-hegemonic, obviously the official colonial discourse was one of brotherhood, emphasizing the cultural ties between Spain and North Africa. But then, for example, in socialist in the socialist press, there was this idea that the socialists were opposed to the colonial venture, and one of their narratives in their protest of colonialism was that Moroccans and Spaniards were equally uncivilized, and therefore we have no right to civilize. So, however, running alongside and sometimes within these discourses of brotherhood, there remains an image of Muslim and Jewish alterity. So the idea that Muslims and Jews are the quintessential enemy of Spain, and this idea of alterity combines ethnicity, religion, and culture as signifiers of difference. So my research explores these ambivalences in representations of Morocco, and I'm particularly interested in how, within post-colonial colonial theory, colonial discourses have widely been read in terms of the power systems they edify, but I'm interested in crises of power, so sort of where power is, the absence of power are revealed in the colonial discourse. And we can talk further about that maybe in the discussion. And then, of course, I'm interested in how representations of Moroccan Muslims and Jews either reaffirm or threaten constructions of Spanish identity. So there are a lot of anxieties concerning non-difference and domination failures. And again, to give you the historical context, it was a very difficult colonization, and the colonization of Morocco was, the colonial campaigns were highly unpopular, extremely costly, and there were some significant military failures. So this idea of absences of power is not just kind of, I mean, it's the historical reality reveals this struggle to really conceive, for Spain to conceive of itself as culturally superior. It never really fully does. So the figures of the Moor, the Moro, and the Jew serve as a vortex, both for national anxieties and aspirations. And Spanish writers look to Morocco to ask the opposing questions, where do we come from and what do we stand against? And I find the notions of cultural and ethnic hybridity that they formulate and incorporate into Spanish national identity very unique among colonial discourses and very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And just before we open it completely, I put like Miles Lama, who is a fellow here at St. Denis College, also based at African Center Studies at Faculty of History, can bring us finally to post-colonial.
I take up Ilya's invitation. I wrote five scribbled incoherent ideas down, so that's all that you're getting. So bear that in mind. I work on sub-Saharan Africa, and very much in the contemporary history period. A few thoughts in reaction and hopefully useful contribution. Study of African nationalism and ethnicity has, I think, been restricted by two problems. One is the strictures and the dominance of political science over and state making as the key criteria for national success. And secondly, the assumption, incorrect assumption, that African nation states are qualitatively more problematic than others. Artificial borders, colonial origins, and so on. Not really true. Nationalist elites, coming off a lot of what Michael was saying, nationalist elites in Africa were the grandsons and sons of the servants and students of empire. Their fathers and grandfathers had helped document African ethnicities and languages and identities and histories for colonialism. And these were individuals who spoke and thought in the languages and cultures and discourses of colonial practice. Kwame Nkrumah, in his own book, talking about nationalism, cites as key inspirations Lenin and Mazzini as inspiring individuals for his own sort of nationalist thought. So they brought these together with pre-existing, uneven African ideas and practices, but crucially sought to present them as in some ways authentically national, rejecting what were labelled as tribal, because in both colonial and independent Africa, the tribal and the ethnic was perceived as an inadequate basis of state authority, the opposite of what could be considered legitimate state authority. And there's continuity then between the colonial and the post-colonial. So I think you've now got a group of historians, I would count myself among them, who are seeking to focus on the making, on the processes of national identity and crucially contested nationalisms in the late colonial, but particularly the post-colonial period, and that this is really the central story of Africa's recent political history, rather than one of states versus ethnicities, rather contested nationalisms. What do African elites make these nationalisms out of? More than anything, I think it's moral notions constituting, drawing on international ideas, intellectual ideas that come from localities, specific local traditions, influenced by religious ideas, moral notions of what it means, therefore, to live well, to do with sexuality, to do with the right organization, appropriate organization of community and society. Two additional thoughts. One was that nations in projecting identity outwards are often perceived by local particular minorities or particular groups as in many ways imperial. in their attempts to impose or certain notions of nation. So we see battles between nationalisms constructed and one set of identities being delegitimized as tribal, as ethnic, and therefore the opposite of the legitimate framing of a nation state. So it occurred to me at one point that we might even think of somewhere like the Democratic Republic of Congo as in many ways a functional empire. It has many of the attributes of empire, but the problems come when it seeks to construct itself as a functioning nation state in a world where nation states are geopolitically hegemonic. However, I would be loath to say that to almost any Congolese person, because one of the really striking things about African nationhoods is that they're very much believed in. Africans are extremely patriotic. This has been a successful process in some respects of creating nations that have mass appeal, but those nations are understood as inherently hybrid for the people involved in them. So it's possible for the majority of Congolese people to believe themselves to be Congolese whilst speaking multiple languages, French, Kiswahili at a regional level, and then a village language, and for most African citizens, operating in these different ways, in these sort of hybrid sets of identities, both Lingala, Lunda, and Congolese, is not something they necessarily feel uncomfortable in. And indeed, these local identities, these ethnicities, so-called, provide the major way in which citizens make claims and make demands on African nations themselves and how they function within them. So I hope that makes some sort of sense.
Thank you so much. Yes, I think I just can open up now to discussion and questions, contributions, other perspectives, maybe anything.